From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf.
Stephen Ranilla returns to the show this week. A frequent contributor to Outside Magazine and New Yorker and other publications, Stephen Ranilla was with us last time after the publication of his book, The Scavenger's Guide to Haute Cuisine, in which he taught us how to cook and eat a pigeon. And his new book is American Buffalo, In Search of a Lost Icon. Stephen Ranilla, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you very much for having me on again.
You know, I said to my wife when I was reading your book, guess what the first thing Stephen Ranilla does in his book, American Buffalo, and she said, kills a buffalo and eats it.
No, that takes that doesn't happen for hundreds of pages.
And I said, yeah. And she said, that is so Stephen. So don't you think you could have studied the animal without killing one?
You know, maybe not. I don't know. I still struggle with that a lot. If you looked at the amount of time and energy that I spent learning about those animals, between when I got interested in them and then when the inevitable happened, I did put a fair amount of time into it. It wasn't like a rush decision. I first got very interested in buffalo or, you know, bison.
Right.
The words are interchangeable. We can touch on that again later if you feel like it.
Yeah.
It's a very contentious argument, but the words are interchangeable. But you guys might be a little bit west of where that argument gets most vehement, which is around the big buffalo states of like Colorado and Wyoming, Montana.
Montana. Mm-hmm.
I think I got a couple threads open right now. But I first got interested in them in a large way in 1999, and I found a buffalo skull fairly intact in the Madison Mountains in Montana. And I knew it was rare at the time because I had never found one, but I didn't know like how unusual and how rare it would be to find an intact skull. And that led me down a long, circuitous path of learning about the animals, and it kind of culminated in like you brought up not so delicately a minute ago when you said that I went up killing and eating one 6 years later. So it was a long time and a long evolution there. But yeah, I think that I maybe could have, but it wouldn't have been as complete of a thing, and it wouldn't have been. In an in-depth relationship that I wound up having with them.
Well, I remember reading, I think it was Dr. John Lilly, who wrote a book about dolphins, and he was a brain surgeon, I believe, and so the first thing he ever did with a dolphin was he cut one open and looked at it.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, and then he realized, you know, as soon as he cut it open and looked at its brain, that he had just done something probably that he shouldn't have done and that he never would do again. But so What about that? You know, so did you have some kind of a relationship with the one that you were hunting?
No, I mean, I didn't have a relationship with the one. And let me just give a little bit of background.
Yeah, go ahead.
Where I hunted a buffalo, in, like I said, in 2005, in the Wrangell Mountains in south central Alaska. And the animals are not, the animals as we know them today, are not indigenous to Alaska. They went extinct in Alaska maybe about 5,000 years ago.
So how did they get up there?
In the late 1890s, the numbers of buffalo in North America were down to fewer than 1,000. And that's from, at the time of European contact, maybe about 40 million. So by 1890, you had somewhere around 1,000 or less than 1,000. And quite luckily, some different people got together, and including some very influential people like Theodore Roosevelt and Andrew Carnegie, and they got together and then formulated some plans and spent some money and started to bring the animal back through captive breeding programs. So that by the time you get in the 1920s, there were up into 20 or so thousand of them.
The number had dwindled to how low?
It's difficult to say, but at one time there was 75 of them in the United States.
Wow.
An unknown number in Canada, and they didn't even realize at the time how many were in Canada. But it was later discovered once aviation, people started zipping around in planes more. Someone realized that there was a population of some couple hundred up around Great Slave Lake in Canada.
So if Buffalo Bill had an airplane, he probably would have gone and killed all of them.
He would have gotten them. Yeah, he would have gotten them.
So what? I mean, they were just hunted to extinction.
Yeah, in a lot, it happened in a lot of different ways. The minute if you were going to look at, and I want to get back to this Alaska thing too,
okay.
but to touch on what happened, how would you go from 40 million to having 75 or so? At the time of European contact, they ranged. We think of them very much as this western animal, but they ranged like they were up in they were in the Florida Panhandle. They're in the Florida Panhandle. People saw them around Washington D.C. They were in Pennsylvania. They were in New Orleans. They were kind of like everywhere. And as Europeans spread, they dwindled because a lot of those populations in the east were just like small fragmentary populations, small herds of them. And people just hunted them for food. And just that little bit of pressure exterminated the fringes of the population. The core of the population, where maybe they estimate now that there are maybe 32 million on the Great Plains, that population started to really decline with the introduction of the horse. Even before Europeans came in, just the fact that the horse made it, Cortez introduced the horse, the Spanish introduced the horse into Mexico. It was traded northward by indigenous populations. Native Americans traded it. They got really good at hunting buffalo with the horse. And then from that moment on, you start seeing them disappear from little fragmentary populations, intermontane basins, and they disappear from the mountains. And it kind of like, it's like imagine a circle, and the outer part of the circle keeps shrinking and shrinking and shrinking down until you just had maybe, again, I keep throwing around these numbers, maybe you had 15 million ranging from the Panhandle to Texas up into Montana by the end of the Civil War. And then a market, an insatiable market for the leather opened up. And people were ordering tanneries in Europe and tanneries in the eastern United States were ordering as many as they could get. And they were paying a lot of money for them. $2.50, $3.50. And you have to understand that back then you could build a house for $350. It was a great deal of money. And people started hunting them with almost an industrial precision. There's a guy, J. Wright Moore, who... and it's documented, killed 25,000.
Wow.
In about 8 years.
I mean, that's many a day, right?
Yeah, just an amazing onslaught. It would vary, but a good day was 40. He claims to have killed 200 in a day.
And what would become of them? I mean, he couldn't possibly have used them all.
No, he will. They say it's figured that maybe about 1% of the meat in this time period, the main hide boom. When all they call it the hide moves, like they're collecting hides for industrial purposes, industrial leather, shoes, belting, anything you'd make out of leather back then. And people used to make a lot more things out of leather than they do now because like synthetic materials are so prevalent now. But it used to be that your coat was leather, your shoes are leather, invariably, upholstery was leather. Often instead of wallpaper, you'd have your house covered in buffalo. The interiors of your house would be done in buffalo leather. It was everywhere. And that big boom, when the market was really strong and there was a lot of animals running around, went from about 1872 to about 1881. In that time period, that final 15 million was gone. And people have cited all kinds of reasons why this happened, that it was that they were trying to eliminate the food source for the Native Americans, that they were trying to clear the land for Euro-American agricultural practices. But really, what it was, what it most seems to be, is that it was people who wanted to make money, and they wanted to make a living, and they wanted to make money really quickly, could go out and with not a very great investment, have the chance to turn a really big profit shooting animals and selling the leather. And that was about all they used was the leather at the time. in that great in that period of time, and it was very brief. And by 1881, 1882, it had become unprofitable to hunt because there was none left. The people who had done it didn't even realize what they had accomplished. I was in the town for a while, Miles City, Montana, and a lot of the people who lived there, their pedigree goes back to individuals who had been buffalo hide hunters, who they shot the last of the herds, and they just kind of were hanging around waiting for more to show up. And it just so happens to be that the last big herd they killed was around Miles City, Montana, and no more ever showed up again. No more buffalo showed up, and they went into other enterprises, started ranching, you know, and they're still, their ancestors are still hanging around there today.
How come nobody ever thought to, you know, if the animals were valuable, why didn't they ranch them? Why didn't they breed them and like they do with cattle?
Well, that kind of leads more into, that starts leading into what we're talking about with the Alaska situation, is that they did. It's kind of weird. It's almost like this great stroke of luck that the buffalo was saved at all. And who wound up saving it was individuals who sort of had this idea that once they were gone, if they were like 99.9% gone, if you had a couple that they would be valuable. And so like capitalists, like ranchers and things would try to get their hands on a couple, or they'd hear a rumor about some that were left and they'd go out and catch them. They'd rope them. And they thought that two things. One, they would just raise them up and have these oddities, like they'd have the last remaining specimen of an extinct species. Or they thought that they would breed them into cattle. And at the time, cattle, this is like kind of like before agriculture had really caught on, like raising grain and stuff. And cattle would just eat grass all year round. But then a big blizzard would come in and kill all your cattle, or a drought would come in and kill all your cattle. And buffalo are so tough, they could handle drought better. They could handle cold better. People thought that they would breed buffalo into cattle and make this mythical beast called the cattalo. And it was these guys who wound up saving them. And after a while, I realized the cattalo thing didn't catch on, but the federal government, under some, you know, with grant money and with donated money and like some popular support, began collecting up these little remnant populations, 3 from this guy, 4 from that guy, a dozen from this guy, and they started bringing them into these areas to breed them in captivity. And all they really wanted to do was sort of save them from extinction. And after a while, like when we left off earlier, you get up around the 1920s, and they had more than they needed. And so they started trying to give them away, and they would spread them around to places they had never even been. And it happens to be they gave a bunch to Alaska. They gave 17 of them to Alaska. And these 17 were brought up to a town called Delta Junction. They lived there for some decades, and they grew greatly in number, and people there didn't know what to do with them all. And so they dumped another 17 of them up in the Wrangell Mountains. And that herd today is the wildest, most free-ranging herd of buffalo in North America.
And how many of them are up there?
About a couple hundred.
Mm-hmm.
And they're very like hard to find. And the thing is, because they're not from there, they're not indigenous there, the state worries that they will kind of displace native wildlife. So every year they give out permits for a few people to go in there and hunt them in hopes that they'll curtail the numbers and prevent them from spreading out. And enough people put in from around the country that it's about a 1.7% chance of drawing the permit. It wasn't 2005, 1.7% chance. And I put in and I drew one of the permits. And so that's how I came to be a buffalo hunter in the great tradition of really consumptive, horrible buffalo hunters.
Well, we're talking with Stephen Rinella, and the book is called American Buffalo in Search of the Lost Icon. And it's a beautiful book. It looks just like a nickel. Well, not exactly.
It's worth more than that, though.
But so you won the lottery of buffalo hunting, and so you got to go hunt one.
Yeah, and I didn't even realize, I wasn't sure what I was getting into. And in this area, in 2005, they gave out 24 of these permits to close to 1,500 applicants. They gave out 24 permits to 1,500 applicants. And of those 24 people, only 4 people wound up getting a buffalo. I think a lot of people, I know for a fact, a lot of people applied for it and then got it and then realized how hard it was going to be, like what you'd have to do to get into the area and the odds of finding one and the time of year and the weather. A lot of them don't even show up.
So you didn't just drive up there with your Jeep and shoot them from the car? And
No. And I didn't know what it was going to be. What it wound up being, did it wound up being something that involved vehicles, a large whitewater raft, a small inflatable personal-sized raft, and an enormous amount of walking in a couple weeks of time. And a lot of discomfort and hardship. And because I don't have a job, I don't have a regular job. So I was able to go practice sort of a siege strategy, and I went up to the Wrangell Mountains there, and I had some friends take a raft down and drop me off in a likely spot, and I just stayed until I found one.
Yeah, and I want to know more about how you hunted it and everything, but the thing must weigh a lot. What do they weigh?
You know, a bull, the male, they weigh up to 2,000 pounds.
Yeah. How about the
one? The females weigh around 1,000 to 1,100 pounds.
How much did the one weigh? Do you know how much she weighed, the one that you got?
I would say, based on some different things, I would say 1,100 pounds.
And so how did you, and I imagine that one of the things you wanted was probably you wanted to keep the skull, didn't you?
Yeah, what I wound up keeping from it was all the edible organs, all of the meat, a lot of the meat still on the bone. For things like ossobuco or something, where it's like the shank, I kept the hide, all the edible organs, and I kept the skull. The parts I kept added up to 700 pounds.
So how did you tote them out of there?
When I killed the buffalo about 3.5 miles from a river called Copper River, and I killed it about a mile from a stream that flows into the Copper River, and that river is called the Chetoslina River. So when this happened, I spent 3 days skinning and butchering the animal and separating the usable parts from the non-usable parts and carrying those the 1 mile distance down to the Chetoslina River. And this was, there's snow on the ground, and it was in October, and I had some things, like there was a lot of bears hanging around.
Yeah, you would think that the meat might attract them.
Yeah, for sure, and the meat froze pretty quickly, but there were still, I saw a pair of grizzly bears the day I killed the animal. I'm sorry, the evening before I killed the animal, there was a pair of grizzly bears in the area, and then they hung around constantly, waiting for a chance to get the remains. And so I spent 3 days and carried the meat down to the Chetoslina River, and then from there I floated it the 3.5 miles in a small inflatable rubber boat down to a big river called the Copper River. And at the Copper River, I was able to load it all into a large classic whitewater rafting raft, that you'd see if you were floating down the Colorado River on family vacation. Loaded it in one of those and was then able to float it down about 20 miles to a small town where I could get it out of the river and into a truck.
No, I won't, because I know you, and I know you write for Outside Magazine, and you're this macho guy, so I won't ask you if you were scared, but were you, say, alarmed at the presence of those grizzly bears?
No, definitely, man, definitely. I don't think it's un-macho, but to have that thing. No, it's like, I really I spent a lot of time, not intimate with them, but it just because of the things I'm interested in and that I do. I spent a lot of time in the proximity of them and around them, and it's kind of it's something you want to happen more and more and more, but it's also something that always makes one a little uneasy. And I never hit that. I still haven't. I don't think I ever will. I never will hit the comfort of the guy that we all know now from the Herzog movie, Grizzly Man, like Timothy Treadwell.
Yeah,
got to be where he just sort of invited the inevitable and was so comfortable and had surrendered himself to it in a way. And I'm not like that at all. I always say this to people, if I could have it be that one got me pretty good,
yeah,
but didn't get me so much that I was you know, I couldn't walk right, or I looked weird, you know. But if I could just get like a nice...
a little scar, scratch.
Yeah, like a nice scratch on my back, you know, I would love it.
I think they'd probably surround you and they'd say, aren't you the guy that ate the pigeon?
Yep, and they would know. But yeah, if I could do that, I would. But no, they really definitely... It's very awakening to have them around. But I like it, but at the same time, I don't like it. It's kind of a... It's a complex relationship.
Well, you were armed, right? I mean, would you have been... Well, you can't shoot a grizzly bear, though, can you? I mean, it doesn't bother them when you shoot them, apparently.
No, it bothers them a great deal. it's funny, in Alaska, the laws in there are kind of weird, because in Alaska, you can kill a grizzly bear to protect property and life. I think they even call it P&L. Like your property and your life. But the thing that doesn't count is your property. If you kill an animal, if you kill a big game animal, like a moose or something, that's not considered your property.
Mm-hmm.
So if one's that like goes into your house and destroys your house, you could kill it. If one is destroying the buffalo you just killed, you have no right to do anything to it.
Right.
If it's tempting to destroy your life, then you do. Also, you can hunt them. Like I could have hunted them in the area I was in. You know, I don't have a desire to do that, but one could. They're quite abundant there, and they're still considered abundant enough to allow hunting for.
So, when you went in search of the buffalo that you eventually caught, how did you find her? What did you do to find her?
I spent a lot of time hiking and a lot of time getting up on really high spots so where I could survey a lot of ground. And that worked to varying degrees of success. And I eventually kind of closed in on an area where I knew the sun were hanging around, or had been. And one morning I woke up and it had snowed not a great deal, but what seemed at the time enough to be inconvenient to me had snowed. And it was a really heavy fog on the ground. And I was just sleeping under a tarp. And so I got up and was kind of waiting for the fog to clear. And then out of the fog came... about 20 of them. And I had spent a bit of time there, and I'd kind of come to grips with the fact that I wasn't going to kill one. And I'd almost kind of like come to like peace with that I wouldn't, that it was like a failed enterprise. And at that moment when it was almost like the moment when I saw one and it was close, I had this feeling almost like that now I would have to do something. And I think that when I was working on this book, and before I began to work on it, I spent so much time reading about the 14,000 or so years of human history on the North American continent that has largely been, the last couple hundred years notwithstanding, has largely been a great, long, epic, dynamic buffalo hunting story. The first people that came over, that crossed from Siberia into Alaska, that's what they were doing. It seems now that they hunted some mammoths and some other things, but it seems now that they spent a lot of time hunting buffalo. And they followed them down, and it may have been pursuing buffalo that led people down into the continental United States on the lower 48. And then certainly at the time of European contact, that's what people did for a living here. And our own, like, if you're Caucasian like me, many of our own Caucasian ancestors during the Neolithic period, like people who painted cave paintings in Europe, that's what they were doing. You feel, when I had one close to me and I was armed, you feel this almost kind of, or I did, this almost kind of like historical inevitability about what was going to happen next. And I didn't think about it a great deal. And I just sort of felt this like push or this weight of this tremendous amount of human history. And I shot it. You know, I shot it and ate it.
Did you think I should use a bow and arrow? Or what did you use? Did you use a modern weapon, a buffalo?
Yeah, no. A weapon that was manufactured in the 1960s.
Uh-huh. So a fairly modern weapon.
By any technological standard, like a completely modern weapon. And no, I didn't. And I'll tell you something that I think about that, too, is The march of technology is another thing, you know, that you kind of get into this. Well, some of those people that came over 14,000 years ago hadn't invented the bow and arrow yet. The bow and arrow is like a fairly new invention in North America. And the animals were probably very tame, and they herded them into corral-like enclosures or into arroyos or into, like, the heads of valleys and just kind of stuck them with spears. And then they began driving them over cliffs after a while, or they would drown them, or they would light immense fires and burn them in infernos. And then we had the bow, and then we had the horse, and then we had black powder weapons. And it's just this ongoing technological revolution. And so, in a way, I didn't feel like that I was really violating anything historical by using kind of the standard weapon of my day, you know. If you're going to go and say, well, I'm going to go hunt with traditional means and you hunt with the bow and arrow, what does that really say? I mean, the bow and arrow's been around 2,000 years. If it was really traditional, maybe I would have driven one over a cliff.
Or thrown a rock at it.
Yeah, it's just like it all seems, these kind of things seem to me, began to seem to me like sort of like arbitrary, or sort of decisions we've made when we look at our own history and the history of our landscape, and kind of try to draw these lines where we pick like that history stopped or started at some point. And like, if you go traditional means, whatever point I choose to ascribe it to, but in fact it's a great long unfathomable span of time that surrounds, you know, that surrounds us and it surrounds the buffalo. And so, yeah, I use the most effective, efficient weapon available to me today.
Which was probably easier on the buffalo than if you had used a rock.
Definitely. That was one thing that really surprised me about it was, I shot the buffalo through the lungs, and it was nearly instantaneous. I wasn't really prepared for what that would be like, but it was just like I shot and it fell.
And what did she taste like?
A lot like beef. You wind up having they eat a lot of green grass, and you have this carrot, and like the carrot in the same stuff, it gives carrot a color, and the fat winds up being very orange. But she was old. She was probably beyond reproductive age, 11 years old. Beef-like and very tough, but I ate it in many, many ways. I rendered all the fat out into lard, which I still have some of that today. After all these years, I still have like a big thing of lard. But the meat was beef-like and stringy, very much red with an orangish fat on it. And you could do kind of anything that you would do with if you went and bought beef in a grocery store. You could pretty much do anything with this, but like a steak cooked rare might be a little tough for your liking. But anything else, pot roast, jerky, I made everything ossobuco, the tongue, you know, just made like a poached tongue, you know, fried heart, liver, pate, you could do anything with it. It's completely, it's like a universal flesh.
Well, as you did with your scavenger's book, did you have a big party and everybody come over and have some buffalo?
No, I didn't. It was more of a, there's a couple things that happened. I had some friends help me that dropped me off and picked me up in the woods. And so I owed them considerably. And I went up giving each of a couple of them, I gave 100 pounds of it apiece. And that trimmed a little bit into my thing. But no, I ate it over the course of about 18 months. And that was like all I was eating, you know.
That was it. You had buffalo for breakfast?
Maybe once or twice. It was mostly a lunch dinner kind of situation, but a lot of dinners. And now I'm down to where I have the skull and the hide and my bottle of lard. And
so you have the skull in your New York apartment hanging on the wall.
It's on the floor.
Oh.
Yeah.
And what about the hide? Is that on your bed or what?
Yeah, I've dabbled with that a little bit, but it winds up being. See, that's one of the things is in New York, like, you know, you live in a building with other people, and so everybody's heat's on, and you can kind of get away with not turning your own heat on, and your house is still really hot. You just kind of poach the heat off everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And the place never gets cold enough to use it.
Yeah.
It's just hot. So I use it as a big rug. I have slept under it a few times, and it just is like overbearingly warm. So someday, if I ever move to an extremely cold thing, or we have some kind of post-apocalyptic situation where there's no like heat anymore, I'll definitely like pull it up off the ground and vac it off and use it. But it makes a great rug.
My guest is Stephen Ranella, and the book is called American Buffalo: In Search of a Lost Icon. It's a wonderful book, and congratulations on it. And thanks for being with us this week.
Thank you for having me on. It was a pleasure.
That's all the time we have for this week's From the Bookshelf. Hope you enjoyed the program. I'll be back again soon with another great show. In the meantime, you can check us out at kusp.org for our podcasts or find us on iTunes. I want to thank our From the Bookshelf staff, Miss Breanne Beal, for all of her hard work. Thanks, Breanne. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Good night, everybody.